let me welcome our next guest, Tony Gosling, investigative reporter out of Bristol. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Tony, looking at the dynamics of all of this, I mean, anyone looking at it, any type of strategic perspective or military strategy, will look at the situation and understand that Iran is not Libya. Iran is not like so many other countries that the United States have taken on in the region and beyond. And the pictures that we've been, the videos that have been coming in that we have seen today, this is not a nation that is in fear now. This is a nation that is extremely angry and a nation that actually definitely wants to do something targeting the United States because of this these assassinations and the way that it was done and on foreign territory. Tell me about that side of things. That is there some type of formula perhaps the United States or Donald Trump is using in thinking that you can just, it can be A, B, C, or D, any nation, all these nations, you're going to have the same reaction? Do they not look and understand the revolutionary nature of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, look, I think when it comes to talking about formulas, there is no real formula to this because the United States military is very much in the pocket, actually, of, well, two very important lobbies. One is the Israel lobby and the other is the military-industrial complex. These are the people that make money from war. Because I think both you and I and most of your listeners, Marcia, will be thinking, nobody wants war. Well, I'm afraid that's just simply not true. Some people do want war. And this, of course, is one of the probably greatest provocations in history in order to try and start a war. Although, of course, President Trump said on Friday evening, he said, oh, I don't want to do that. I'm trying to stop a war. Well, of course, the opposite is the case. This is the sort of action which is likely to start a war. And there are people that want this sort of thing to happen, unfortunately. They don't get any scrutiny, really, in the Western press. We've seen a very lily-livered response from Dominic Raab, the British Foreign Secretary, and from Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister. They are sort of almost too embarrassed to call out the American President Donald Trump and the American military for what is an incredibly reckless action. I would compare it actually to the June 1914 assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, which precipitated the First World War. It's that level of provocation and that level of a dangerous act which they've taken. The only way they can get away with this kind of really unhinged, maniacal action, and of course against all international law, is they are the lawless ones. Let's be absolutely clear about that. The only way they can get away with it is with a compliant and pliable Western media that doesn't ask the difficult questions, the awkward questions about what are the implications of this action. And the implications are pretty horrific. And all you need to do really is to look at Donald Trump's pronouncements to pick holes in every single thing he says. In fact, almost everything he's been saying is the opposite of the truth, Marcia. Unbelievable. He says, for example, that Qasem Soleimani was caught in the act and terminated. Well, correct, he was terminated, but he wasn't caught in the act of anything. He was actually, just like millions of us do, departing from an international airport in a vehicle. And he wasn't in the act of anything. He was talking to, and I would imagine consulting with, the senior military in Iraq. And all this has done is it's now, I think, sent a very clear message right across the Middle East what the American presence in the Middle East really means. And that is an occupying force, first of all. Secondly, an invasion force, which is no longer wanted. We just had the Iraqi parliament make that absolutely clear. They want the US troops out of Iraq. And so this is the sort of provocation that you would expect from a an administration which has really just run out of ideas. All it seems to know how to do is to use its little gadgets, its technology, its drones. In a way, what this is a sort of the modern manifestation of what in the 1960s and 70s we called the space race. You know, the idea of a rocket to the moon really means that the US has now got its satellites up, it's trying to dominate space, so it's watching people as they move around, and when it decides it wants to kill someone, it's now saying, well, actually, look, it's sending out a very clear message. We can assassinate and kill almost anybody we want to on the planet. And that, I'm afraid, is not a message which is going to give any respect for the US around the world. It's a diplomatic disaster for the United States, I think.
Indeed, that's what is being said from around the world. As you're looking at images, the earlier images that you could see out of Mashhad, the holy city of Mashhad here in Iran, where the bodies of these martyrs have been proceeding and went to the shrine of Imam Reza. And, of course, now they're going to be flown to Tehran. They all started in Iraq, in Qazemain, right outside of Baghdad, and after Qazemain, went to Karbala. After Karbala, Najaf. After Najaf, then to Ahwaz, Iran. Now in Mashhad, being flown to Tehran. And tomorrow, a major ceremony to be held in Tehran, a funeral procession and also a prayer, the funeral prayer that will be led by the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. We've been talking, of course, about the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, also Deputy Lieutenant Abdul Mahdi Mohandas. I want to mention the name of the other four individuals who were martyred in that attack: Hadi Tahromi, Vahid Zamanian, Shahrud Mozafrania, and Hossein Jafarzaneh. I want to, of course, mention these individuals, all of these individuals who were with Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. One of them, the General Hossein Jafarzaneh, actually had been with Lieutenant General Soleimani for decades and was always by his side. All these individuals who sacrificed their lives in trying to keep not only Iran safe, but the region safe from terrorism, from the terrorists, and they had been victorious over Daesh, and they definitely stopped the plans of Daesh and their supporters from being able to take over various states, and ultimately they wanted to totally destabilize the region. So that's why they're being commemorated, and they are revered, they are respected, well loved, and that is why everyone is demanding, actually, that the United States pay for this crime. Well, when I look at, I want to take a look at social media, and there's Abayomi looking at Colin Kaepernick. Actually, he had a tweet. He says, America has always sanctioned and besieged black and brown bodies, both at home and abroad. American militarism is a weapon wielded by American imperialism to enforce its policy and plundering of the non-white world. Your take on that tweet?
It's a very poignant statement. It is accurate. It sums up in a few words the history of U.S. imperialism, its utilization of state-sponsored terrorism, the militarization of politics, both inside the United States as well as internationally, and someone like Colin Kaepernick, who has experienced racism himself, who was actually forced out of the National Football League because he dared to take a knee in solidarity with those families who have lost loved ones to police terrorism. So yes, I think it's, his statement is a reflection of how people in the United States, progressive-minded people, peace-loving people, actually feel about the actions and the political trajectory of the United States at this point.
And Tony, with that being said, There have been many that said that this is a turning point, that by the time this finishes, the United States has started what will lead to its removal of its military bases and troops in the region. I want you to talk about that side of things.
Well, of course, there's a lot of pressure for that now. There's actually pressure internally within the United States from the Trump administration itself. There's a lot of people close to Donald Trump that are aligned with his policy of removing U.S. troops from the Middle East, from particularly from Syria and Iraq. So there is some pressure from within the U.S. to do that. I would suggest that this act, perpetrated really by the military, I wouldn't say this is an initiative of the White House. It's something that Trump, I think, has been strong-armed into going along with. It's something that the military have wanted for a long time. But, of course, the most important impetus for that is going to be from right across the Middle East. Look, the America is 6,000 miles away. What are these troops doing there? Of course, it's quite a different matter for Iranian troops or Iranian soldiers to be in Iraq because it's only about 600-700 miles from the Iraqi capital. 6,000 miles is a lot further away, and there's a lot of people around the world scratching their heads and wondering, what are these people doing there? Of course, the answer really is partly to do with oil, but it's also partly to back up the Israeli attempts to dominate the Middle East. So look, you know, we've had from denials from the United States, haven't we, saying, oh, we don't want to start a war, although of course their act, it does appear to be a deliberate attempt to provoke possibly even a world war. That's how serious this action is. But the Israelis have not hidden their wish to have a war with Iran at all. In fact, the most recent, I think it was from the new defense minister, Naftali Bennett, he was actually relishing the prospect of having a fight with the Iranians. So one must wonder to what extent the Israelis are trying to use their lobby groups and pressure groups in the United States to get the US to come along with their, what is it, the 1980s Yinon plan to balkanize the Middle East, to disrupt it as much as possible, to enable the Israeli state to then expand. Now, that is a quite well-known plan, certainly around in the Middle East, but it never gets discussed anywhere on the Western media. One other thing, though, I would say, Marcia, is the Israelis are famous for their false flag attacks. Now, there's even a motto for their secret service which says, by deception shalt thou do war. And one thing that this provocation by the United States has done is it's opened a window of opportunity, a horrific and horrendous one, and that is of some kind of false flag attack which could then be blamed on Iran, actually carried out by the Israelis or their allies. And that, I think, is something that we all need to be very much aware of. If there is any kind of response, we need to be absolutely clear who that response really is by, because the Israelis are not beyond actually attacking their own people and attacking Americans potentially in order to try and spark this conflict. That's how much the senior people in the Likud party actually do want to have a conflict. And they are aligned, of course, with the people, Marcia, sorry to say, that make money out of these massive wars. We're talking about now the Western arms industry and the arms companies, who are completely out of control. They have no real control by the government, and they dominate foreign policy nowadays.
And of course, you mentioned, Tony, about the Israelis, and Major General Mohsen Rezaei, in a speech tonight in Tehran at a ceremony that was commemorating these martyrs, actually said that if Iran is attacked or certain other places attack, then Haifa will be attacked, the military sites in Haifa would be attacked. Your take on that statement?
In fact, endangering the existence of U.S. as well as Israeli presence throughout the entire region. And the United States is in close collaboration with the State of Israel. All of these military maneuvers and military actions that are taking place in the region, there, of course, is the subsidizing of the State of Israel, of its business community, by the taxpayers of the United States to the tune of billions upon billions of dollars every year, the transfer of weapons technology intelligence technology between the United States and the State of Israel is well known. So yes, it's no secret that the State of Israel's views the Islamic Republic of Iran as their principal adversary in West Asia. And as a result of this, the U.S. itself also views Iran and its influence in the region as a source for the continued occupation of the region. But I don't think these occupations have achieved anything except bring about more death, destruction, and displacement. Right now, internationally, as a direct result of U.S. imperialist wars, there are anywhere between 60 and 75 million people displaced in the world today. The worst level of refugee crises and displacement since the conclusion of World War II. So they have wreaked havoc in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya. So their whole project is doing nothing except bring about massive casualties, premature deaths, and a displacement of people from their homes. And this has even created political crises in Western Europe, with a large influx of refugees and migrants to Europe and also here in the United States.
Well, Tony, how do you assess this? There are many that says that, you know, there's so many signs coming out of the actions of the U.S., not just these actions, but other recent actions, that's a sign of an empire in free fall. And we saw a few different actions that just took place that some analysts say that the United States saw how its influence is waning, if not totally cut off now, in the region. We've seen recently, we saw the maritime maneuvers with China and Russia and Iran. I mean, obviously, very strong allies, that if we look at it like that, with Iran and actually doing maneuvers together. We've seen Iraq and China signing various economic deals to help rebuild that country. We've seen closer ties between Moscow and Tehran, and the cooperation, of course, in Syria. Your take on that side of things, Tony?
Well, I think the United States has proved it's got military power. But by using that military power in this totally unlawful, illegal fashion, it's losing influence every day. So people are respecting what the United States says less and less. They're trusting the US less and less. I mean, let's be honest, they have been really since the 1960s and 1970s. As the US has become this empire that's trying to expand. And we're now getting to the proportions that we had from Nazi Germany. These kinds of actions, literally arrogant regime change attempts to move into a country and totally take over the government, assassinate leaders like Gaddafi was assassinated, and then destabilize the country in order for them to bring their troops in. I mean, to a large extent, many of these countries, of course, it's oil resources that the United States wants to take over. And this shows you, really, that it's a military objective at the end of the day, because oil is one of those resources that countries and empires more specifically need in order to fight major wars. And so it seems that the wish to have an enormous war in the future sometime seems to be driving this obsession with taking over these oil-rich countries. But what really shocks me, Marcia, today, hearing about the Americans targeting apparently 52 different sites in Iran, including cultural sites. Now, read my lips, this is including things like historic sites, UNESCO sites, museums, this right. kind of thing. This kind of targeting is a sort of thing. Do you remember we saw ISIS doing this? We saw Daesh attacking these sorts of sites? This is just how low that the United States strategy has now gone. They have no actual credibility.
Tony, let me just jump in. Is it symbolic of just how low the strategy has gone, or is it a continuation? Because you said we saw this with ISIS, and we know some unbelievable historic sites were destroyed in Syria and in Iraq. Of course, who is ISIS? I mean, if we go back to what Donald Trump said himself, he said that ISIS was an entity that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton created.
I certainly think that there's a lot of evidence for that. The Turks, for example, when they were a bit more friendly with the Americans in NATO, were allowing troops to come in, mercenaries effectively, from the Turkish border down into Syria, etc. And money was then going in the opposite direction. Oil money was going. I mean, there's definitely very close links. We've had Scott Bennett as well, the former psychological warfare officer in the States, who exposed the links between Swiss bank UBS and other banks and the funding through these banks of Daesh ISIS. So this is basically a proxy army which was set up. I think it's pretty clear, everyone can see, rather like Al-Qaeda, you know, which was started under Operation Cyclone back in the 1980s in Afghanistan, then went on to, the Americans went on to use these mercenaries in Bosnia and in the Yugoslav wars. And these mercenaries have then been used and paid to get involved in all sorts of Middle East conflicts, particularly Al-Qaeda, and then in Libya, and then ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So there's definitely a connection here. And this is one of the reasons, I think, that maybe Qasem Soleimani was so hated by the US military. It's that he was one of the key people who put an end, along with Vladimir Putin and his air power, to the ISIS operation. Of course, Donald Trump likes to claim credit for that, but it's another one of those empty statements that the Americans are making on this front. But I come back to the cultural sites. This really does show that the Americans have got really no credibility left. If they're attacking sites like this, what they're doing is they're trying to wipe out world history and world culture. And obviously nobody in the world is going to allow that sort of attack to go unpunished in terms of credibility. Anybody that's trying to wipe out history and our culture, of course, is an enemy of humanity. And that's where the United States Pentagon, Washington, and the think tanks around that, the neocons, these expansionists, that's where they are now. They're a threat and an enemy of the culture and the history of humanity. And they better get on the right side of history, I think, pretty quick. Otherwise, what we're going to see is these people being accused, quite rightly, of being the enemy of humanity, Marcia.
Enemy of humanity, Tony, interesting title, and many would agree. And we look at the situation, Abayomi, and of course, I've been reporting a while and remembering the type of images that we saw coming out of Syria when Daesh was there and attacking almost at will. We saw, of course, the beheadings. We were getting films in that basically was just too hard to even watch. We saw crucifixions. We saw bodies being burned alive. We saw the unbelievably old cultural sites. We saw churches being destroyed, being blown up. And of course, some of the shrines, Islamic shrines, some of them lesser known, had been destroyed. And some of the major ones, of course, people like Lieutenant General Soleimani and others went there to protect these historical sites from being destroyed. Again, the same people who have been targeted by the American regime. So when we look at all of this, and I'm really looking at it, one, from an American perspective, I am American, and trying to understand other Americans, the American people right now, can they not understand that the individuals who have been killed were the ones who actually defeated these head-cutting, liver-eating terrorists that actually is for all of humanity? It's not a matter of just helping the Syrians or the Iraqis or the Iranians, but helping all of humanity, as we saw Daesh actually involved in attacks in Europe and other places.
Yes, this is a very important point, because of the distortions of the United States and other Western corporate as well as governmental media sources. They do not tell people the accurate information about what's going on. Even in Western Europe and the United States, many people are confused by what they see on television through the so-called news channels, what they read in their newspapers, because some of the same interests who control the media in the United States are the same people who have close ties with the defense industry. They're producing all the arms that supplies the military and the intelligence forces to carry out these operations around the world, to carry out operations inside the United States against oppressed communities, where the Pentagon transfers highly sophisticated military weapons to local police agencies. So in terms of them attacking cultural sites, this is a part of the history of imperialism. It reminds me of Dr. Frantz Fanon, who published The Wretched of the Earth in the early 1960s. In that book, there's a whole chapter on the question of national culture. His theory was that the struggle against colonialism and imperialism is also a struggle for the reclamation of the oppressed people's national culture. And the national culture of oppressed people is still under attack. And we've seen that in so many of the wars of occupation and genocide that the U.S. has waged just over the last 3 decades, where they've bombed historical sites, where they've disrespected religious sites. So this is a part of the whole pattern aimed at the dehumanization, the demoralization of people who are being targeted for occupation and for colonization. So the struggle for the preservance and also for the reclaiming of national cultures is part and parcel of the whole struggle against war and the struggle against imperialism.
Well, while listening to you, actually, it made me think, I'm sending this over to Tony, it made me think, actually, about what the Israeli regime has done, speaking of cultural sites and basically trying to wipe out various sites. And, of course, we've seen many places that have been destroyed. And of course, it's totally occupied. It almost seems that there is such a similar technique that has been used by the Israeli regime. And we're talking about Israeli interests in all of this. And, of course, when we talk about targeted assassinations, we know that the Israeli regime actually has a lot of experience in that. I'm wondering if there has been not only coordination, of course, between the Israelis and the White House, but actually telling them how to do it and exactly what needs to be done.
Well, look,
what do you think, Tony?
Well, we can talk about Israel as a regime right now because there is no stable government in Israel. There's no properly elected government. What you've got basically is a bunch of hawks all trying to vie to be the prime minister. There's going to be another election. It's the third one this year because the system has broken down there. There is no proper democracy functioning in Israel anymore. And that's an important word to use, regime, because this is the word that the Western media always uses to describe a nation that they don't like, that they are trying to soften up for regime change. And what with the Israelis, they really do have an incredible amount of chutzpah, of cheek, because they are a nuclear power. It's believed that they have something like 200 nuclear weapons. Their nuclear program started in the 1960s. By the 1980s, they're an incredible nuclear arsenal. And there they are actually talking up the idea of having a Middle Eastern war. Now, that is seriously a problem, and the United Nations Security Council should literally be sitting there debating what to do about Israel and its nuclear capability, undeclared, by the way, because if the Israelis did declare their nuclear capability, it would mean that the United States would not be allowed to supply them with any money, which they do, of course, every year to the tune of many tens tens of billions of dollars because of the laws in the United States mean that you cannot send money to these undeclared nuclear states, and Israel is one of them. So there's a deep hypocrisy at the heart of the Israeli nuclear weapons program and the nuclear weapons capability. So these are the people we need to be concerned about. And of course, it is only normal and natural for the Iranians to be considering the possibility that they may need to become a nuclear weapon state too. Look what's happened with North Korea. The North Koreans have faced down Donald Trump and effectively won because they're saying you're not going to attack North Korea because we have nuclear weapons too. So of course there is thinking within Iran which is saying, well, we need to restore the balance of power in the Middle East, because there is this complete lack of information in the West and a lack of acknowledgement. It's really a case of denial, psychological denial, by the Western supporters of Israel and by the Israeli state about even having this capability. So with that sort of ability, the nuclear weapons ability, the Israelis have literally got to be a very democratic, a very sensible and a very measured state. But of course they're not. And that's, I think, one of the most concerning aspects to all of this is the irresponsible attitude, the far right, the racist attitude, the racist laws that there are now against Muslims and against Palestinians in Israel through the Nation State Act, which was implemented just the year before last. It doesn't give rights to other citizens. I mean, we're seeing a similar kind of thing beginning to take shape in India under Modi with his Hindu nationalism. But within Israel, I think we need to be absolutely clear that this state has to be questioned all the time by the UN, particularly the fact that they just simply seem to totally ignore UN resolutions about all the land grabs that have been going on over the last 30 or 40 years of the Palestinian territories. And also, just to finally say something about the targeting of Qasem Soleimani, is an unbelievable thing. Let's just think for a moment, what would be an equivalent person within the United States military for the Iranians to assassinate? And what would be the consequences if, say, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Sir Mike Milley, who, by the way, was only in November in Iraq itself, what if he was to have been assassinated by the Iranians? What kind of reaction could we expect from the Americans in that case? Of course, it would be absolutely furious and an incredibly angry reaction, and we would probably be at war by now if something like that had happened. So we just need to understand that there is no real responsible attitude either from the Israelis talking up war or the United States using their satellite technology and their drone technology literally to try and start a war. And I think that all of the emphasis now is really on the Iranian government, the Iranian cabinet, and those that run the country to come up with some kind of measured response which does not simply respond to this incredible provocation in the way that the Israelis and the Americans seem to want, which is with an enormous kind of military response which would give an excuse for the warmongers.
Abiyami, we have breaking news there at the bottom of your screen, if you can see it. I'm not sure. It says the Iraqi top cleric Sadr calls for canceling U.S. security deal and closure of the U.S. embassy. And, of course, earlier today, we saw the Iraqi parliamentarians voted for a resolution that foreign troops have to leave Iraq, specifically talking about the Americans. Now, they've passed this resolution. We have calls to close the embassy. Now what? If the Iraqi government says, okay, USA, you need to pack up and leave these bases, we're reclaiming our country, what type of reaction you think that they would see?
Well, I don't think the United States is going to leave right now unless they're forced out of Iraq. This is an appropriate measure on the part of the Iraqi government to ask the United States troops to withdraw, which they had no business there anyway from the beginning, and also the closure of the U.S. embassy. I mean, this is clearly a violation of the national sovereignty of Iraq. How can you go into someone else's territory, carry out targeted assassinations, bombings, openly admit that you committed these crimes and then refuse to heed the requests by the host government to leave. So this is only going to magnify tensions and military conflict in Iraq even more. We're looking at 17 years of continuous war waged by the United States against the people of Iraq. So this is going to continue, and this is all a direct result of the failed policies of successive U.S. administrations. This didn't start with Trump. We can go all the way back to George Bush Sr., who carried out the war in 1991. We can look at George Bush Jr., who occupied the country in 2003. We had the Obama administration, which maintained troops in Iraq, even though they said on numerous occasions they were pulling out, that they had pulled out, which was a false statement that was made. And now we have President Donald J. Trump, who maintains troops in Iraq, maintains troops in Syria and Afghanistan. And even though when he ran for office, he claims he was going to withdraw from these theaters of war that have been waged by the United States. Just a few weeks ago, he said he was going to withdraw troops from Syria. He said the same thing last year. And then he turns right around a few weeks later to deploy additional troops. The same situation with Iraq. He said he should pull out. The United States has no strategic interest anywhere in that region. Yet, we just heard over the last few days that thousands upon thousands of more U.S. troops are going to be entering Iraq. Even though the Iraqi government has clearly stated that they do not want U.S. military forces occupying their country. So they've set up a situation for the expansion of this war throughout the region.
Well, Tony, now the Iraqi government has protested. They have actually filed a complaint with the United Nations and also with the Security Council, talking about a breach of its sovereignty. And, of course, these assassinations is terrorist acts taking place in their country. Possible reactions. What do you think is going to happen on that side of things?
Well, I'm a little bit more positive than our other guest. I think that there's now going to be an enormous amount of pressure on the United States to pull out of Iraq, particularly if there is no specific, in that part of the world, response by Iran, that really their credibility of these troops can just be allowed to melt away as the world sees what they're doing there. They're not there for any kind of security. They're there just simply to project American power and to attempt regime change. We heard just a few days ago 3,500 more troops apparently are going to be sent to Iraq. Now, this it's important from the American point of view to do this, but I don't think that there's really any justification to keep these troops there anymore. And specifically, I'd like to see pressure from the UN, pressure from around the world to instruct the Americans to leave the area. Obviously, the conflict is likely to escalate between Iraq and the United States. The Iraqi government is not entirely powerless. It can use diplomatic pressure, but you know, it can start to give approval to popular uprisings against US troops. Okay, so it would set ordinary people and militias against an occupying force, but then I wonder how long the Americans could stay there if this was to carry on. I mean, we've seen in some countries, for example in Lebanon, enormous attacks on US bases in the past, which have led the Americans to be forced to withdraw as hundreds of US troops potentially could be targeted. So it's not, I don't think, a credible idea to think that the Americans can stay here much as they'd love to now, unless, of course, that the Americans can come up with another kind of excuse to do so. But I'd also like to point to the track record of the US in Syria and Iraq, because we've seen two attacks over the last 5 years, chemical weapons attacks, both of which have been blamed on Syria and on President Assad. And yet the actual results have been, through Carlo Del Ponte and through the United Nations, etc. And we've just seen a report just before before Christmas about the more recent Duma chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, the other one before that. Both of those attacks were attempts to fabricate a chemical weapons attack. So, in other words, it was sponsors of, or people sponsored by, the British military, the White Helmets, and others who were actually trying to create a chemical weapons attack in order to, as a false flag, to blame it on Assad of Syria. Now, that it makes it absolutely clear their game plan. So that what they were prepared to do is to kill tens or even hundreds of innocent people in order to try to blame whichever country they want, and then use their spearhead for war, which is the mainstream media. That's what the mainstream press has become, as we remember the whole weapons of mass destruction nonsense, which was peddled before the invasion of Iraq, to use the mass media in order to try and smear and blame a country, whether it's Syria, Assad, whether it's Iraq or whoever it is, and to provide a very brief casus belli to actually act and to attack, as the Americans, of course, did under Trump, send a load of cruise missiles into Syria, even though it's now proven that Assad and the Syrians had nothing to do with that attack. So I think we need to be extremely vigilant. Keep our finger on the record button if anything happens, and make sure that we record every single thing that comes out of our media, because it's quite feasible that something like this may be tried again, having seen it, the track record with these chemical weapons attacks, which were blamed on others, which were perpetrated by the West. So that's their track record. I think we need to just be aware that may happen, that sort of thing.
Well let me get Abiyomi in his final question. I mean, you just heard what Tony was saying, and basically make sure we keep our fingers on the record button. But as he talked about the chemical attack, and we know at the end of the day that an international organization, OPCW, actually still they, because of Wiki whistleblowers, now we know that basically some of the inspectors knew that and had reported that there was no proof of a Syrian government involvement on those, in those chlorine attacks, even if there were chlorine attacks that took place from the air. So my question is that, so we have the Security Council, we have China, we have Russia, we have France, we have the UK. We have the U.S., of course, there. And so, if Iraq, now Iraq is complaining to the United Nations, the Security Council, what can they expect, though, realistically, from these entities?
Well, these issues should be raised before the United Nations Security Council, and it'll be very interesting to see what the positions of Britain, France, Germany, and Canada will be in regard to this whole situation.
Of course, let me just say, what the Germans actually today came out with a statement basically supporting that and condemning Soleimani for what they said, what he was involved in. So perhaps that's a hint of what's coming from these Western countries.
Yes.
But go ahead.
Yes, and I think the China and Russia and other entities internationally, even outside the UN Security Council, should continue to voice their criticisms and condemnations about this latest episode of U.S. Provocation. We know they have a history of staging these type of false flag operations, and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons investigated what supposedly happened in Syria as early as 2013. Obama was trying to utilize an alleged chemical weapons attack to engage, along with Britain, in a massive airstrike against Damascus. And there was international outrage against it. They could not get the endorsement of the British Parliament at that time. Today, with Prime Minister Boris Yeltsin having been re-elected, or having been elected to head the British government, what is his position going to be if they are requested to engage in some type of joint military operation with the Pentagon against Iran? So yes, we should definitely monitor these efforts on the part of the United States. We know it's a huge fabrication and falsehood that Mike Pompeo is articulating in the Western media right now,
okay,
that they somehow prevented these killings of U.S. citizens. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. And the media has an obligation to expose those falsehoods.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me. Abiyomi Azakiwi, editor Pan-African Newswire out of Detroit, and Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol. And of course, viewers, we're going to be continuing with our coverage of, well, what now are the processions leading up to the funeral that was going to take is going to take place on Tuesday. Before we go, once again, I'd like to read the names of the martyrs. Of course, we know Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Deputy Lieutenant Abdul Mahdi Mohandas. Four other individuals were also martyred: Hadi Tahromi, Vahid Zamanian, Shahrud Mozaffarnia, Hossein Jafar Zania. These are the names of the six martyrs who were killed in a U.S. terrorist attack on their vehicle on Friday in Baghdad. And we thank you all for staying with us here, right here at Press TV. And of course, we're going to continue with our coverage, but right now we're going to actually again show the very powerful speech by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, regarding these assassinations and what's to come. Thank you so much for staying with us right here at Press TV. I'm Marzia Hashimi. I'll see you tomorrow.
Alhamdulillah. Thank you. Thank you very much. In the name of God, the Almighty, the Most Merciful. Thank God, the Blessed. And may peace be upon our great Prophet, Abu Qasim Muhammad, and his family, his spirit family, and his friends and companions, and all the prophets and the good beneficent all over the world. May peace be upon you all. God Almighty says in his great book, the Quran, the Holy Quran, do not consider those who were killed in the name of God Almighty as dead, but they are well alive, they are with their God Almighty, they are happy with God, what God has given them, and they are aspiring to what they see, and they have no fear in their hearts, and they have no sadness and sorrow in their hearts. They have full faith in God's promise, and that he will not let them alone. Today we are holding this ceremony in order to honor a great leader, an Islamic leader, a great historic leader, who is Haj Qasem Soleimani, leader of Al-Quds Brigades in the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, and he is a friend, and also a dear friend, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who is the deputy of the Hashd al-Shabi, the popular forces in Iraq, and all their companions of the martyrs, the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were with them and were martyred in the latest crime that took place. Of course, today, the second day of January.
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you.
The night of Friday, or in the Friday Eve, if we take a look at it as December 2nd, 2020, is a history, is a date which is a transition in the region. This is the beginning of a new age, a new history, a new era, not only for Iran and Iraq, but the entire region.